Hello, and welcome to Music Maps, the Rock and Roll Book Club podcast. In each episode, we'll use a place as a jumping-off point for a conversation about music, anywhere from the obvious to the obscure. Hello, Simon.
Hello, Mark.
It's another musical map.
It is.
So today we'll be making our first trip to a music city which needs no introduction. We're going to Manchester and we'll be talking you through the early years of the Stone Roses.
Yeah, so we'll talk about the formation of the band, the release of the debut album, and hopefully we'll get all the way up to the iconic gigs in 1989.
And I think any listeners who are worried that they're going to have to listen to us will like this next bit, because it's not just you and me who's going to be talking about the Stone Roses. And frankly, we know nothing about the Stone Roses. But we've got John Robb. Hello, John.
Hiya, you okay?
We're very well. So, John, everyone knows who John is. But by the way of intro, I'm reading what it says on his Amazon profile, because I've assumed that this has been written by professionals.
Don't trust them.
So, John Robb, Simon, do you know this? John Robb is a many-faceted creature, bassist and singer for post-punk dark energy mainstays, The Membranes. Best-selling author, absolutely. Radio, TV presenter, journalist, DJ, publisher, model. He fronted a Doc Martens campaign in 2016. Talking head, and also puts on his own music and books event, Louder Than Words. We bow down to John in that regard. He's been doing this for many years. And John has written many books. And today, we might talk about his Art of Darkness book, The History of Goth, at the end. But no, we're going to take him away from the current book he's selling and talk about the one he did about 15, 20 years ago. The Stone Roses and the Resurrection of British Pop. With a young Ian Brown, who moves from his birthplace in Warrington to Sylvan Avenue in Timperley, where one of his neighbours is none other than John Squire.
Yeah, so it's interesting when they first met. I mean, they only lived about three or four doors apart. It's only a small road, Sylvan Avenue. It's quite suburban, like Timperley. The other thing that's quite funny, I was thinking, people don't often mention it in the Stone Roses context, is that Frank Sidebottom is the other person who came from Timperley. I always wonder if their paths cross. I mean, there's quite an age gap.
First thing I thought of when Timperley came
Frank. Frank was a genius, wasn't he? Frank was amazing. So, that's quite two great pop cultural things come out of this really nothing sort of suburban bit of Manchester. But didn't they met in a sandpit, didn't they? And had a little, when you're 5 years old, what kind of fight would he be when you're five? He'd just be a grumpy little, two little kids who don't really want to hang out with each other. And then as they grow up and they're on the same road, they're going to get to know each other. And I suppose the psychology of it is that they're very different people, but they fill in each other's gaps, don't they? So Ian Brown was always the leader of the gang and he's always a bit more outgoing. And John Squire was very quiet, but very studious and very artful. I mean, Ian's very artful as well, but he's not a person who would sit in his bedroom for hours learning how to play a guitar. He'd just do off the top of his head type of person.
But he introduced John to the Clash and the Sex Pistols and things like that when they became friends as teenagers.
I mean, I think John would also claim he'd found some of the stuff himself. I think John was more the Clash and Ian was more
Everyone
the Pistols.
Does that.
Yeah. But actually, it's interesting because it shows their personalities, doesn't it? Because the Clash are a bit more art school and the Pistols are a bit more... The core of the Pistols is a bit more off the cuff with John Lydon. And to this day, Ian Brown is a massive... It's his favourite band. The last time I saw Ian Brown in the summer was a Jamie Reid exhibition just before Jamie Reid died, actually, in Manchester. And I hadn't seen him for ages. And he was there because he's still a massive Pistols fan. And you could sort of see that in the Roses, that thing about grabbing, not grabbing defeat from Jaws of Victory, but that thing about you could have been the biggest band in the world, but you just destroyed it anyway, is very Pistols, isn't it?
Yeah, so they end up going to the same grammar school and then they go on to the South Trafford College after that. But in 1980, they form a short-lived punk band, The Patrol. So what can you tell us about them?
They weren't just a ramshackle youth club band. they were really good. Like Funky Side's drummer, and he's a great drummer already when he's that age. And John Squire is really good at guitar. So all that, that idea, they had this kind of scruffy youth club band and I had to really graft to get the band to the level of the Roses, they hit the road running. I've heard all the gigs because when I did the book, I interviewed the late Pete Garner. It's really sad that Pete died a few months ago because he had all the tapes. He had everything.
Okay.
He had the archive. So he
was involved along with Andy Cousins.
Yeah, he wasn't in the band. He was their friend. So yes. He was, you know, there's always a mate who's in the band but isn't actually in the band. That was Pete because he's in the gang in a way. And so he had all the tapes, the gig, and he would never share them with people because he didn't want, it's not for him to share them with other people. But he played them while I was doing the interview, so I actually have them by default in the background of the interview with Pete sort of talking. So I'm one of the few people who've ever actually heard The Patrol.
And the first gigs, March the 28th, 1980. On a punk bill at Sale Annex Youth Club. 30p to get in. And support from Suburban Chaos.
Ian Brown's playing bass, Andy Cousins is singing, John Squire's playing guitar and Funky Size on drums. But you can tell already that John Squire's guitar playing is ahead of everyone else at that level at that time. It was very well played.
So The Patrol peter out in 1981. So what happened in the... Because there's like a four-year gap here between... Well,
Ian Brown sold his bass and bought a scooter. The scooter thing, the schoolboy thing is really interesting. It's a very much a platform of that period's Northern youth culture, which isn't talked about an awful lot. And actually, what's really interesting, it turned up in the book, that Clint Mansell from Pot Leetself was in a Midlands scooter gang, and they knew each other from then days. So Ian Brown and Clint Mansell had known each other before anybody really properly got into bands and things. So Ian Brown had this really famous, in that little world, a really famous scooter that had a little coffin on the side and things. And he spent all his time doing painting up and doing it. So very artful. And John Squire, he also had a scooter as well. And that was really painted. They're like little works of art, really, weren't they? And it was just, they would go up to Blackpool, cause trouble, come back again. And Ian Brown, he's flat top then. And Ian Brown was also, he was hanging out with the Angelic Upstarts at that point in time. Not really a roadie, but a gang of 20 kids who go to all the gigs and help lug the gear in and get him free. And Menzies remembers him really well from them days, not from the Stone Roses days. He remembers Ian Brown as being one of the little skinheads, kind of scooter boy crossovers who hang out with the Upstarts. And think it was probably very good for Ian to hang around with Menzies at that time. But you know, when 14-year-old kids, they're easily swayed about what's going around them. So I think Menzies was a good older... An old, not a statesman, but good old brother, really, for these people to have. And they were a great band, a really underrated band. And Ian loved all that stuff. He loved the Cockney Rejects. I mean, I'll just jump forward slightly, but when Rennie comes to the first rehearsal, I've got that tape. No one else has got this tape. And he comes in and you hear him introducing himself to the band. He goes, "Hey, I'm Rennie," quite extrovert. And they go, "Hello, I'm John," in a really dour voice. And he goes, "What's the plans for the band?" And they're going, "We might be able to get a gig with the Cockney Rejects in Manchester." And this is quite a long way later. This is 83, 84. And they're still in their heads thinking they're somehow part of this kind of street punk scene. From the Cockney Rejects to the Stone Roses isn't that big a gap, really. It's just the Cockney Rejects got trapped into a world they weren't really part of. And if they'd appeared 3 years later, the Cockney Rejects would have probably been a Stone Roses kind of band, more music for lads, wasn't it, really? So the other guys in The Patrol, well, Funky Si, he's spotted quite early on, been a really good drummer, so he went on to play with Terry Hall for a little bit. So he's actually getting proper work in bands. He rejoins the Stone Roses for when they finally get in the starting point. And then he also plays with Johnny Marr. So he's in when they got the Freak Party with Andy Rourke, when they're putting that together, because Johnny wanted Freak Party to be a sort of funky band. And Funky Si got into the funk from The Clash. That was his route in there, because Topper was his massive influence and that. And The Clash had a little funkiness to them in parts. And so he's in that. And Johnny Marr wanted to be an ACR kind of indie crossover thing. They're trying to work it out, really.
Yeah.
And then one day, Johnny Marr got this new singer down. And Funky Si didn't like the new singer. So I think he actually makes a demo with him, doesn't he? Then he leaves. So Funky Si, in the end, left the Stone Roses, the Smiths, because that was Morrissey, and ends up with 11 Years in the Fall, but loved all of it. So the two biggest bands he walked out on, but never regretted it. Yeah, so, and John Squire had gone to work in Cosgrove Hall making the little models for...
Danger Mouse.
Yeah, I think
Wind
he did.
In the Willows.
He worked in Danger Mouse, didn't he?
Count Duckula.
But who else was there? But Barney from New Order.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Is it, at the same time?
Same time, yeah. and he never talks about it, does he? Yeah. So it's quite interesting, Johnny, that John Squire was actually going to make a career out of being very artful, but he's pulled back into being in a band all the time. That was his real love.
So Johnny Marr nearly asked Ian Brown to join the Smiths at one point.
There's loads of crossover between the Smiths and the Roses. There's another one before we get to that. That Johnny Marr was always, he was a kid in town. He used to manage X Clothes. I remember him when he was manager of X Clothes when he was about 16, which was like the goth clothes shop in Manchester. And he was in there. In fact, Tony Wilson had gone in there to ask Johnny Marr to replace Paul Wigan in Section 25. Yeah, but he thought they were too old for him because he was just a kid. So he get the bus back to Withenshaw, and on that journey was Pete Garner. So Pete Garner, who was working in Paper Chase Records in Manchester,
yes,
which was the alternative record shop and stuff like that. He's the first one I met because I went there, took my fanzine in there, and he was dead nice, and I got to know Pete really well. And this would be about 1980 or something. And they would get the bus back together, and there was Johnny. In fact, I interviewed Johnny a few months ago, and he told me this story that Pete Garner said to him, "We've got this band together now." And Johnny's going, "Oh, that's great." And he says, "What's it called?" And he said, "I think we're going to call it the Stone Roses." And Johnny said, "That's a terrible name for a band." He says, obviously now, Johnny says he thinks it's a great name for a band. He said, "That was the worst piece of advice I ever gave anybody." But he said he had the feeling that was Pete that came up with the name. But I thought John had come up with the name.
Yeah.
But maybe these things get blurred over time, don't they?
And wasn't there a gap? I mean, another band before.
Oh, there was a whole series of
the
bands.
The Waterfront. Who were the Waterfront?
That was Andy Cousins. I think Manny was involved in that a little bit.
And
John Squire was in there. And also the two guys at the High were in there. They got to know Andy Cousins. Obviously went to school with them, but Andy Cousins' dad... I think Andy Cousins' dad was quite well off and in a really big house. They had a room they could all rehearse in. So they all used to rehearse around his house. And they were going through lots of different names of bands. These bands didn't really do proper gigs or they didn't do proper stuff. And they had another singer called Kaiser, who was a Scooter Boy skinhead from North Manchester, who looked really hard, but has got a really sweet voice, actually. So on the demos, they got that track called Normandy, haven't they? And it's a really nice tune, but it's not that far away from the Roses. It's all in place. Ian's not involved because Ian's now living in Hume in Manchester and he's doing his schoolboy thing. And he has
a chance meeting with Gino Washington.
Really weirdly, this morning I went for a jog in Manchester and I ran past the Reno, where the Reno Club was, and I'd thought about that. Right. It's just really odd, isn't it?
Yeah.
So he went to the Reno Club and Gino Washington was having late night drinks in there, and they took him back to a party in Hume. And Gino Washington, and even if this is a slightly exaggerated story, it's such a great story, isn't it?
Yes.
And he's going, "You look like a star, you should be in the band." And then he rings up John Squire and says, "I'm going to come down and play in the band." I think that's when he realised, because he always was a star. He stood out in the crowd, Ian Brown. He always had that charisma. That's that thing where people always go, "He's not a proper singer." One, he actually can sing quite well. First, Rosie's record, his voice is a fantastic vocal on that record. And if it's hit or miss, I grew up with punk rock. It's when people moaned about Susie's vocals on the comeback tour. She's slightly flat. I go, "What's happened to everybody? Everybody wants it to sound like the record."
And then coincidentally, he gets a call a few days later from John and decides to rejoin the band.
Yeah, and I think he's already thinking about it. I mean, they were still mates. I mean, because John had been a Scooter Boy, but John wanted to be in the band thing as well.
And you've already kind of introduced us to Rennie coming in. And again, like a lot of bands, there's quite a bit of flux.
Yeah. So they put an ad in a notice board in A1 Music in Manchester, and who replies but Rennie?
Rennie walked in and he saw it, and he put the sign off the wall and put it in his pocket because he knew he didn't want anyone else to get it. Just from the notice, he never met them. Rennie's from East Manchester. He's not part of their crew. He's from a completely different world. Musically, it's a pretty different stuff. His favourite song was Jump by Van Halen.
That made me laugh.
Yeah, I know, but that's what's cool about Rennie. He just likes his stuff, doesn't he?
I like that, though. Yeah. I like the fact that he didn't... You know, he was cool to say that was his favourite song.
Cause... Yeah, but the press conference when they reformed, he's gone about U2, I remember that. There's a slight level of awkwardness, wasn't there? Because they're all looking at him going, "What?" So he goes down for... this rehearsal tape is amazing. So he goes down. I've got the rehearsal tape to Funky Sign Drums, and he's great. Funky Sign is a really great drummer, right? He's really good at what he does, but Rennie was completely the perfect drummer for the Roses. He is the greatest drummer of his generation. He's the number one. He goes in and he starts drumming on a song he's never heard before, and within 10 seconds he's got it, and it sounds amazing. It sounds like the Stone Roses.
But he plays the songs differently every time.
That's what Pete Garner always said. Yeah, he said every time he played with Rennie, he'd play completely differently. The drum rolls have been different places and stuff like that. And Pete always said he was never a proper bass player, but Rennie always really liked Pete's bass playing. So when Rennie did his band after the Roses, he rang up Pete and said, "You've got to be in a band with me because you're a lot better than you think you are." But they couldn't make it work because Pete just didn't really want to do it, I don't think. But his energy, the swing, his cockiness and his swagger is all really important. And then he give him a mic and he's got the greatest backing vocals ever. I mean, John Leckie told me that Rennie was in the studio with him. He would do like 20 tracks of backing vocals in thirds, fifths, sevenths, falsettos, deep and everything. And they're on the record, so that you can't hear them all, but there's banks of Rennie in the background. Well, I remember when they reformed and Ian Brown said the best thing about the rehearsals was it was like watching the best band in the world as a singer, thinking, wow, this band is really good. And he was like really praising Rennie, saying, yeah, because I always said that was my little saying, he was the best drummer of the generation. And thankfully it stuck because it's true. But he said he was up there at the level of the greats like Gene Krupa or Buddy Rich, all those kind of people. And
so people would have paid to see him.
Yeah, I mean, we always said that. Whenever I bumped into Ian Brown, we always say, like, Rennie on his own. I always said, in that gap where they weren't going, I always said, if I bumped into Ian, I said, you don't actually have to reform. We've just got to get Rennie back out again, because it's like now, isn't it? It's like he doesn't play. It's like mad, isn't it? I think some people are so virtuoso, it's actually boring. It's just, well, all I do is play the drums. Yeah, but you play the drums like nobody else. But to him, he's just playing drums. It's too easy. Yeah.
Now, you meet them for the first time this in person around this time, because your band, The Membranes, are in a studio. Is that Spirit Studio?
Yeah, it was Spirit, but it was in Chorlton. So the Spirit had two studios, one in town and one in Chorlton. So we just got to Manchester, we just moved there. So we were in West Isbury then, in the Bedsit Land, and then the nearest rehearsal room was Spirit. So we went down there. Steve Adge used to run it, actually. And sometimes he didn't turn up with the keys. I remember that. So you'd have to go home again.
Can you remember how much you had to pay?
It wasn't very much. It would be about £2 or something. Carmel was the other band next door. Yeah. And we were loud. We were probably the loudest band in the country. And we could hear them coming through the wall, Carmel. So when we rehearsed next autumn, we must have drowned them out. It was Sad Cafe, I think, used to have the room before. You could find Sad Cafe's lyrics lying around on the floor. It was a really odd collection of bands. And then one day they heard this other band in there and they're rehearsing and they're quite anthemic songs, early Roses kind of sound. I thought, these sound pretty good. In fact, they reminded me a bit of a band in Blackpool called VVV, who had a similar-ish coming out of the Clash anthemic post Chameleons-y sound. I mean, the Roses weren't that far away from the Chameleons at that point in time. I don't think they were trying to sound like them. But that sound, to me, that was a true sound of Manchester bands until Ecstasy turned up and changed it all. Very emotive, quite in a way kind of introverted, but anthemic songs, but really catchy. So, and we've seen them going into their rehearsal room and they look pretty hard. Because Ian Brown does look hard, doesn't he? And we thought, God, they look shifty.
Especially
looking
with the shaven head.
Yeah, they look like shifty scallies. So we thought, like, so, but one day I broke a string and I thought, I'm going to have to go and ask that band next door for a string. So I knocked on the door and I went in the room and of course they were dead friendly, weren't they? And then I saw Pete, I thought, oh, God, it's Pete Garner. I didn't know you were in this band. I had no idea this is a band. He told me about them before, a year before. I didn't realise it was the same band. It just didn't twig. I thought, oh, Pete. And so I knew him. And they used to give us a lift back in Andy Cousins' big white van, because Ian Brown used to live next, at that point in time, had moved next door to my guitar player. So in West Didsbury, on what's that road called?
And sounds more like a village than...
It's small. When we say Manchester, it's village. Manchester, everybody knew everybody else, didn't they? All the bands always knew each other. And to this day, when I speak to Noel Gallagher, it's like, is it unspoken code where you don't bitch about each other? I know some people always stick to the code, but it's like you look after each other. So, yeah, so we went in there and they go, oh, we thought you were psychopaths. They thought we were dead mad. Also, at that point in time, weirdly, we were in the top 10 of the indie charts. So we were like the big band and they were like the local band.
I'd forgotten about this, but their first gig as the Stone Roses is actually in London.
Yes, supporting Pete Townsend at the anti-heroin benefit gig.
Now that's a step up from, no offence to Mency, that's a step up from the Angelic Upstarts, isn't it? Supporting someone from The Who.
It's in terms of record sales, I think in terms of being good rock and roll bands, I think Upstarts are up there. I think they're a very underrated band. But yeah, I mean, I know Pete Townsend's really famous now, but it wasn't a big gig. It was in the Moonlight.
The Moonlight in Hampstead.
Yeah, which I played there. It only holds about 100 people at the time.
October 1984.
Yeah, so they did this gig, and this gig's actually really interesting because Pete Townsend tries to poach Rennie from the Roses that night because obviously they got Rennie drums like Keith Moon.
Yeah.
And he must be standing and it's at the sound check. He's watching going, oh my God, this guy's probably better than Keith Moon. This is Keith Moon who hits everything all at once but in time. Yeah. So he joined him
for the encore in the end.
Yeah, and he asked Rennie to join in the band. Well, and Rennie said, no, I'm in the greatest band in the world now. So that's an incredible thing for a kid to turn down. Because I remember, of course, we see him all the time in rehearsal rooms, and Rennie, really cocky, he's the cockiest kid I've ever met. And so he must, you think, well, if he's that cocky, you think, well, I'm going to go play in Pete Townsend, I'll end up in The Who. But no, he stuck with the Stone Roses. He knew how good they were. It's quite telling, isn't it? And also that night, Gary Johnson, Gary Bushell's best friend, Oi the Poet, the punk Oi Poet, he gives him a review. And the week later that he gets and come back down to London, and that's their first interview. And they get a little cutaway on the front of Sounds, a little picture of them in 1985. Nice. After doing one gig.
Yeah.
And there was quite a buzz on them at that time. And then Howard Jones starts managing them.
Yes. Yeah,
Manahan is in to produce them. So they
get management almost immediately.
Yeah, almost immediately. It looked like this band is going to make it within 10 gigs. It looked like, wow, the fast track. But the wheels come off, don't they? I think Hannett was the wrong person to produce them because he can't produce a drummer like Rennie. You can't do that, you know, that
sort separation.
Of, yeah, it doesn't work, Rennie. He has to play everything all at once. And that brittle, I mean, Hannett's a genius, but you have to be with the right band. And that kind of brittle sort of post-punk, post-whatever sound doesn't suit the Stone Roses. They're a psychedelic band and you need the warmth.
Yeah.
And they need that kind of they have to play off each other, really. It's not about playing separate, which was Hannett's trick on it there. Everyone plays separate. Yeah. And
so Martin Hannett comes into it via the manager, Howard Jones.
Yeah, and that's the reason that Tony hated the Stone Roses, wasn't it? Because he'd fallen out with Howard Jones and he didn't want somebody he perceived as a rival in Manchester's band to do well. So, I mean, it's petty, isn't it? But it's small scene, isn't it? And also he'd fallen out with Martin Hannett at that point, hadn't he? Because Hannett wanted all the factory money to go into a studio, state-of-the-art studio, and not the Hacienda. And Tony was right culturally, but I think Martin Hannett, if he got his studio, would have ended up being the Trevor Horn figure. Because I was talking about this about something yesterday, but I think Frankie Goes to Hollywood's album, the debut album, which is an amazing sounding record, is almost a culmination of the Martin Hannett sounds, but sadly Martin didn't do it, did he? So,
all so they try to make an album here, but 1985.
It actually sounds good, the album.
Their first attempt at an album.
They'd done just before that, they'd done that tour of Sweden, which did five dates, which was their Beatles and Hamburg moment to gel them as a band. And it's a mad tour, and they're going around Sweden. But when you actually look at the set list, it's already there. Everything's there. I want to be adored. They played their first gig.
Yes.
This Is The One is already knocking about.
So This Is The One and I Want To Be Adored were on.
Yeah, they're all recorded. And I mean, most bands, if you've been a student of Martin Hannett and you came out with something you thought was all right but wasn't really that good, you probably would have put it out in the 80s because you think, I'm never going to get another chance to do this. But they said, this is not right. We're not going to do it. We're going to disappear for 3 years and get it right. You've seen Walker Down Burton Road, Bumper Dee and Brown Walker Down Burton Road keyboards going to work out vocal melodies at John Squire's flat in Chorlton or something. Every day they'd be working at it in complete isolation because the music scene had moved away from those kind of bands. They were on their own. But they had that sense of purpose. They just knew. I think it comes from Ian Brown. I think Ian Brown knew. Because he was like, you remember as a kid when all the mad people would charge you and try and beat you up, and there's always one kid who wouldn't run away. That would be Ian Brown.
So just on the subject of gigs, that their first, so they were playing in London initially. They didn't really play any gigs up north to start with. First northern gig was in Preston and was notable for ending in a riot. So what happened at this gig?
Weirdly, we'd played there about a month before. Right. There'd been a riot as well. The bouncers attacked us on the stage.
Oh, so there was just riots there every gig then?
I think it was only when we played Stone Roses.
They were the only two riots.
But somebody threw a glass, didn't they? Then it went off, and the Roses went up there with the crew, because the people would see the Roses up north were all the Scooter Boys. So they went on, always 100 people would turn up. That's the beginning of the whole thing. They always had this mad crowd, and they went up to Preston, and the locals didn't like this mad crowd. And there was a bit of like teenage argy bargy again, wasn't it? And like, and it went off and it kicked off. And the bouncers there were old school bouncers who didn't like music and piled in. So it was a big scrap. The myth is they only played headline gigs, but they didn't. They supported Plain Jane, didn't they? And they're like a psychedelic, almost like a Brian Jones type massacre kind of thing, psychedelic guitar thing. And there wasn't much of a scene for that stuff there, but the Roses getting into this kind of more psychedelic edge to stuff. But there was no gigs for them to really play. There was nothing going on.
There wasn't many venues.
So there's hardly anything. The university put stuff on now and then. The Ritz wasn't really a venue. But the cool thing was that Steve Adge said, let's put on a party, our own party, and invite all the Mad Scooter Boys down there, all the heads we know, all the people we know around town, and have our own gig. It's such a cool idea. And he got the warehouse unit out, across the road from the Star and Garter, actually.
Fairfield Street.
Yeah.
Behind Piccadilly.
It's one of the rare buildings in Manchester that actually still exists.
Oh, it's still there? Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Incredible.
And you put two Roses and one ACR gig on, and the police turned up at the Roses one, didn't they, the first one and things, and but they managed to fob them off, didn't they? Yeah. But the entrance was, because legally you couldn't charge for entrance, so you had to buy a can of beer on the way in.
So talking about members of the Inner Circle, Steve Adge being one, when does Cressa come into it?
Cressa was mates of the Mondays and the Roses. So, and he's actually mates Ian Brown before the Roses. They used to put on a Northern Soul night and they were like best pals and that. I still see Cressa now and then. He's been on the streets, but he's getting his life together.
Well, Haslam did that book about him, didn't he? Yes. It's an Art Decade series.
About 2 years ago?
Yeah. Yeah, he's had a tough time, but he seems to be getting his life back.
He's living in a house, he's off the streets, so, yeah.
One of the other things the Roses did around this time was an infamous graffiti campaign. Tell us about that.
One day at Spirit, Rennie turns up, he gets off his little scooter because he's got his scooter there, and I have a little chat with him. He's been dead cocky as usual, been funny, he's dead nice and that. And he goes, I see the name Membranes everywhere, because me and the drummer of the Membranes, we had felt tips, and we just used to write the name everywhere we went and that. But the drummer at the Membranes got fined for writing on Preston Station, got caught. So he said he's seen it everywhere, and we go, well, that's because we have loads of fans. And we didn't. And it was obvious that about a week later, the Roses was sprayed all the way from Ian Brown's flat in West Didsbury all the way down, all the way into town, wasn't it? All down the road.
And impossible to tell who must have done that then.
Well, we knew, but we couldn't say. But it was cool. But then everybody in Manchester got really snooty about it, didn't they? So again, Tony, he completely banned them from everything, didn't he? He said, they're not playing the Hacienda because they vandalised civic buildings in Manchester. And Colin from the Boardwalk said, they're yobbos who vandalised the city, they can't move in. Which would have been great if they moved in the Boardwalk, because the Boardwalk was the best rehearsal space in town. The Mondays were in there, we were in there. Everyone gone to the Boardwalk. That was the epicentre of what was going to happen next. But the only band who wasn't in the Boardwalk was the Stone Roses because of the graffiti campaign.
But they end up rehearsing at the International. So this
is the masterstroke. Yeah.
Through Gareth Evans.
So they went into interview him to talk about getting managed, and he pulled the drawer out of all the gold bars in it. And it sounds made up, but if you've ever met Gareth, that's not a made-up story. And he was so mad that they just thought, they just liked him because he was so mad, and that's how they got him to be the manager. And of course, in the end, it ended up being a complete disaster. But I would say, in the early days, he was perfect for the band. He'd give away tickets for the gigs, he spent loads of money on it, and he thought they're the best band in the world. And also, he let them rehearse in the International 1 and the International 2. So instead of being cooped up in a tiny little claustrophobic rehearsal room like everyone else, they're rehearsing in a full PA on a massive stage of the International 1, which is a big venue. So they knew how to sound good. They knew what monitors were. None of the rest of us did, because we never had monitors. And they knew how to project on a massive stage because they'd actually been on a big stage loads. It was very fortuitous, that part. But the minute that band started getting big, he was so out of his depth.
So I think Andy Cousins leaves around this point, and then this deal comes about with the Wolverhampton-based Revolver label for a one-off single. So what was the song that they chose to make?
Well, the Revolver thing's interesting because people go, why did they sign to Revolver? Why didn't they go and sign to EMI? But it weren't like that. Nobody would sign them. it was the only record label in the country that Gareth went to that had any interest in putting that record out. So that's why they had to sign to Revolver. And it wasn't the greatest deal, but they couldn't get any other deal. I mean, I suppose now looking back on it, he should have set up a record label and put their own record out. But I don't think anybody in that... They weren't from the DIY underground scene. And Gareth certainly had no idea that you could put your own record out. I don't think he's in touch with the independent thing at all. He probably just banged in every door, and the only door that opened was Revolver. And that's how that came about. But it was actually, in the end, it was another step that moved them on. Until sadly I was never happy, I needed so much more. Red clouds, oh, they used to chase me. I remember going into the International and Gareth giving me a copy of it, which I still got about 2 months before it came out. This is about 1987 now, isn't it? So
yeah, so we get into 1987.
Well, this is the next interview after the 1985 Gary Johnson interview, is my interview, because I'd started writing for Sounds in 86, and from the day I got into Sounds, I was saying, you've got to cover this band, you've got to let me cover this band.
So at this point, they're a big draw in Manchester.
They're drawing 200-300 people at gigs, which
but
I know...
Still, but they're being ignored by the London
press. But people in London were going, well, how can they be drawing 200-300 people in Manchester? No one knows who they are in London. Yeah. People actually said that. They go, look, we don't wait for your permission to like bands in Manchester. But they were actually quite a big band in Manchester. But the Chameleons, again, have been the same. I mean, we support the Chameleons, the Free Trade Hall, the main venue, in 1984, and 1,500 people were there. But people in London did not recognise Chameleons because they get 300 in London, so therefore they can't exist. The Roses was an even worse version of that. They could get 300, they were getting up to 400. The Internationals are getting busy at this stage. So I interviewed him. This is the second interview. I went to Ian Brown's flat. I can remember it really clearly. I can remember doing the interview, and I can remember on the wall he had the If poster from the film on the wall. I could almost remember the whole interview, what he said and stuff like that. Yeah. And he was funny, and he knew he was going to be... They knew
they were going to be big at this point.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think Pete Garner leaves, and I think Manny rejoins around this time.
Manny. Well, they actually asked Paris Angels bass player Scott to join, and I think they said to Clint Boone, have you got his number? And Clint Boone gave it to Greg, Manny's brother, and Greg gave it to Manny because Clint Boone wanted Scott to be in Spiral Carpets. I think that was the story.
Right.
So
okay.
Scott's number one all-time favourite band is the Stone Roses. He could have been in them. But there was another guy who was in them for a week. He's actually on the Ian Tilton photo session for my interview.
Rob Hampson.
Yeah, for 1 week he was in the Stone Roses. Mm-hmm. So when you look at the pictures of my interview, that's not Manny, that's the other guy, yeah.
Right.
And they're great pictures. I mean, Ian has got 14 Stone Roses sessions.
So this is Ian Tilton.
Ian Tilton, who grew up...
He's
a brother of the guitar player, lives next door to Ian Brown. So I've known Ian since he was about four, because he's younger than me. But he's got amazing sessions. I wish he put them all out. He's got loads of great photos of the Roses.
Yeah, if you look him up online, he's got quite a low profile. But obviously, on the debut album, he took the photos on the cover of There that were recorded at... On the Other Side of Midnight, is it called? The Tony
Wilson.
Yeah, he's
Wilson got that, yeah.
First TV
he's
show.
Got his, also, Simon's got the one picture. And also, Simon took the front cover shot, didn't he? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we're around 1987 now, and late 87. And there is some label interest. And I think there's a flip between Rough Trade and Zomba. Now, Zomba, they've got this imprint, Silvertone, that they signed to. And the guy behind Zomba is Andrew Lauder, who's a big industry figure. He started United Artists, didn't he?
Andrew Lauder is arguably one of the greatest A&R people this country's ever produced. Hawkwind, Stranglers, Buzzcocks, was it?
In fact, Happy Trails.
Yeah. It's incredible the stuff he signed.
Plug, book plug last year. White Rabbit, Hat Tip, White Rabbit. Happy Trails, Mick Houghton, the biography of Andrew Lauder. Well worth a read. Anyway, that's an
aside. I've met Andrew Lauder and he's brilliant. He's a total music head. But But the other thing that's interesting here is the label Stone Roses should have signed to his creation, isn't it? Surely. How did Alan... Every time I see Alan, I say, how did you miss that one? If there was ever a band that was perfect for creation, who completely adored creation, obviously...
You just say in the book, they were the only band he missed.
I know, he regrets it. And also Primal Scream, because Primal Scream were an influence on the Roses, obviously, with Made of Stone. And I saw the Roses at a Primal Scream gig. They didn't go to many gigs because they were rehearsing all the time. They were getting the band together. So you could see if they were on Croatia, it would have been so perfect because McGee would have done it right. Because Alan is a completely brilliant manager of bands. The way he gets those bands to operate without falling apart. He works with mad people, makes them do the job, doesn't he? And the whole thing, I mean, the Mad Chain would never cause a riot in their lives, but Alan McGee caused all the riots. And he made them seem like the Sex Pistols, didn't it?
Yeah, so they don't end up on Rough Trade, but they do record Elephant Stone with Peter Hook, which I think was intended to come out on Rough Trade.
But... Rough Trade would have been a good deal for them, I think. I think Rough Trade would have understood how to do the Roses. The thing about the Roses was the business side of it was always chaos. But Creation was chaotic, but Creation would have held it together. And Rough Trade had an infrastructure which would have held the band together, I think.
So, May 1988, there's a kind of famous gig, isn't there? The Anti-Clause 28 gig, organised by a friend of the Rock and Roll Book Club, Dave Haslam. Hello, Dave. At the International 2, James are headlining, and the music press are starting to kind of take notice. Liam Gallagher's at the gig, I believe. Noel Gallagher. Were you at this
show? Gallagher met the Inspiral Carpets, I think, at the gig.
Yeah, I was at the gig, yeah. So Noel Gallagher met the Inspiral Carpets that night because Graham from the Inspiral Carpets, who we'd always known for years as this kid who turned up at every gig recording, taping the gigs. And Noel Gallagher spots Graham recording the gig that night and he goes, "Can I have a copy of the cassette?" And that's how he got to know the Inspiral Carpets. Uh-huh. He went separately from Liam because he didn't want to go with his little brother. So Liam had to go with a mate from school. And Liam goes to that gig and he blows his mind. And of course he blows his mind. It's great. Ian Brown walks on famously with the Bell. And they go on late, don't they? This is the beginning of the Roses, the tease thing, isn't it? The band, you can't see the Pistols thing, innit? Of course you see him at the end, but they go on half an hour late and it ratchets up the tension, doesn't it, and things. And also it's quite interesting because James was one part of Manchester, wasn't it? Music, their fan base, and the Roses is another, because the Roses still had the bit of the tail end, that Scooter Boy crowd, and James is much more of the Chorney crowd. I mean, I love James, I think they're a great band and that, but there was a very different vibe with the two bands, wasn't there?
And it's at this show, I mean, we know they played I Want to Be Adored, but it's at this show that they actually open up with it. And that's really classic Roses, that, isn't it? That's
tease, where... again. Yeah. Tease, I mean, isn't it?
You go on late. They must have opened every gig since with it.
Yeah, how could you not? I mean, you come on late and also you have a song that starts with just the bass. I mean, most people go on with their wham, bam, fastest song to get the crowd jumping, don't they? But this song smoulders. I mean, that's quite cocky. I mean, obviously now, because it's so that's one of the most loved songs ever, that people go, one note, and everyone goes, whoa! But then it'd be like, wow, what's this? When are they going to start?
So around this time, they're making the debut album, obviously around this same time, and John Leckie comes into it around this point. So he was originally suggested by Jeff Travis?
Well, two stories, isn't it? Originally suggested by Jeff Travis, but also Manny was a massive fan of Dukes of Stratosphere, and John Leckie produced that. Dukes of Stratosphere is an amazing psychedelic pastiche record. It's my love, XTC, one of the greatest bands ever, and it's an amazing record. But he saw that John Leckie had produced it, and he said to the band, we should get this guy to produce the album. So that's their story. The Rough Trade would probably say they brought in John Leckie. Again, it's all blurred in time. But I tend to think probably the band's story does seem to make sense, doesn't it?
And there was Paul Schroeder engineering, because they wanted a mixture of someone from the dance world and someone such as John Leckie.
Although it doesn't sound remotely like a dance record. The only bit that sounds a bit dance is Rennie's doing four to the floor kick drum here and there, isn't he? The thing about that record, though, it's not an acid house record, right? But what it was, everybody going back from Ray's, been listening to dance music all night, so they put them on the cassette on the car. It's such old school, isn't it? So they soundtracked that generation without sounding like acid house. That was the thing, wasn't it?
Yeah. By the time they get in the studio to make this record, they've been planning this for years, so they're completely ready. Some of it's made at Conk Studios, which is owned by Ray Davies, but most of it's made in a place in Willesden called Battery Studios.
I've been there. I did my album there.
Right.
Yeah. It's a great studio. It's a really good studio. It's got an analogue desk. So that's probably why they use it. Also, it's owned by Silvertone. Right. In fact, Silvertone's parent company owned that studio.
So they were getting it from 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. 55 days.
Those are weird hours to work.
Quite a long time, that, really, for recording the first album.
But the label owned the studio. So it's not expensive.
Go in every night and take your time because the label owns.
I tell you, he's also in there during the day. I think probably Johnny J. He was doing stuff during the day, so they bumped into each other. Yeah,
Cleopatra. We like Johnny. Johnny, one of the unsung heroes of Manchester.
Johnny's mega. I see him all the time. Yeah.
So Made of Stone comes out, and Wilson's relented, perhaps, because they're playing at the Hacienda.
Well, no, I think Mike Pickering.
Maybe Tony's away in LA and he doesn't know.
Tony was amazing. This is not bitching about Tony, because Tony was amazing. But really, the person who's a musical force in Hacienda is Mike Pickering, who's finally, after all these years, going to put his book out and set the record straight.
Ooh.
Because he's the key guy. All the bands were booked through him. All the nights booked through him. He's the guy who started playing acid house first there. He was the architect of the music and the culture of the Hacienda. And I don't think he's that bothered. He doesn't really. He's made his money in that. But it bothers me that he doesn't get the credit he deserves. Yeah.
He seems, always struck me as being at ease with that.
He's totally at ease with it. But I like to see people know the real story. It just annoys me. It's nothing to do with me, is it? But it just annoys me that the wrong people get the credit. He should get the credit. So he would have booked them in there because he knew, of course.
But weirdly, I mean, the band go out, so they've got all this love. It's starting to happen for them. They go out on the First National Tour. Actually, it's not that well attended, is it?
No, they're big in Manchester. And they do these gigs. They do, like, you go out on that circuit tour. They play Shrewsbury. There's 30 people there. But there's 15 people from Manchester there. Turn up in the flares, and the other people in the crowd are looking at the other people managed to go, whoa, there's been a shift.
Right.
And everywhere they go, and I actually know most of the promoters of those gigs, and people went to those gigs, and everybody I interviewed, all people I've spoken to since then say every single gig, it was like punk. When the Pistols, it's very similar to the Pistols, when the Pistols will play Whitby, Scarborough, or Northallerton, a place that nobody ever plays, and they would turn up looking like the Pistols, and most of the locals want to kill them. And three of the locals want to be them. And they go, so the Roses are the same. People go, where did you get the flares from? There's something moved
So
here.
Where do the clothes come into it? Quite near the end of the process.
This is 88, 89, 88 probably. And there's an endless argument who wore flares first. I mean, I think the Mondays could probably state that claim, because Phil Sachs, it's a great story, isn't it? Phil Sachs had his jean stall in the underground market, and he got a job lot of flare trousers left over from the 70s. And he couldn't sell them for 20p, and then Sean Ryder and his mates come in and go, what a laugh, let's get these on and put them on and start walking around town, and their mates start wearing them, and Phil Sachs go, put them up to a tenner. And he couldn't get enough of them, and that's kind of where it all started in that. And the Roses weren't, I mean, they were a latter, they were later on that look, because they were still, you see those pictures in 87, the sounds thing, was still the Paisley shirts, Ian's got short spiky hair, they've all got diggers, long leather coats on, that was their look. They look cool, but it wasn't that street look. The street look came, as Noel says, they were probably the last of those bands to get onto that look. But they looked the best when they got on it, didn't they?
So the album's finally released in May of 1989. So how does the album hit upon release?
I gave it a 5 out of 5 review in Sounds, and the Enemy gave it a middle of the road, sort of not very sure review.
Really. So mixed to a degree.
See, that was a great thing in Sounds. You could, as a freelancer, you could dictate the narrative, whereas Enemy, if it's a new band, well, what's the midweek chart position? It'd be all, we have to be sure this is going to be big if we get behind it. A Sound, you could just go in with 2 feet. I'm going to put my neck on the line and say, this is the greatest band ever. And all the letters page were full of people going, it's all hype, we hate it. But then a year later, of course, they'd all be into it, wouldn't they? And that's why that was the best music paper, because you got they trusted you. They didn't necessarily like, the people around the paper might not like the music you liked, but they let you write about it relentlessly. Yeah.
So She Bangs the Drums, which was actually released on my birthday, 15th of
July. That's why they released it on that page, wasn't it?
They must have known. This gets them on Top of the Pops with the Happy Mondays.
It was the Manchester night, though. It was quite a thing, wasn't it? As you track them coming out of the big gigs, the Hacienda is the first. That was them storming hip Manchester, wasn't it? They'd finally been allowed in, and they stormed it that night, so they became the toast of Manchester. The next one's Blackpool, the Empress Ballroom, because this is quite touching for a Blackpudlian, because most people in England look down on Blackpool, but Manx love Blackpool. There's never been one person I've ever met in my life who managed to, whoever goes, you're so lucky growing up in Blackpool. Ian Brown to this day, he goes, you're so lucky to come from Blackpool. What's it like growing up there? I go, a bit boring, really. But they think it's amazing. They still go there. The holidays, it's ace. So, of course, they go and play the Empress Ballroom. Because now, Empress Ballroom's on the circuit. Everyone does Empress,
yeah,
don't
yeah.
they?
Yeah.
Then, the Jam had done it in 82.
Oh, okay.
There weren't many bands played the Empress, so it's quite an event.
Yeah.
And it's about the first time I've been back since I've left. And it was ace to go back to my own town. And the Empress is an amazing venue, if you've been in there. It's just beautiful venue, isn't it? 3,500 cap. And it's risky because, they, as you say, they play places like Shrewsbury, whatever. But 2 days before they played the Empress Ballroom, they played Brighton to about 50 people. And then, so you go up there, and it's like 3,000, 4,000 kids in flares. The whole look, you think, whoa, this is really shifted, hasn't it?
Yeah.
And I mean, that's the first gig when the music press got on it, because the music press are brought up to that gig by Hall or Nothing. And the music press, still not really sure what this thing is. Suddenly they're going, Jesus, there's a youthquake going on. And it was so exciting to be in a youthquake moment in the town I grew up in.
Yeah, can imagine.
With a band that I knew. It was just like, Jesus, this is all happening all at once. What a perfect synchronicity. It's, the best gig was Glasgow Green, but the high point culturally was Blackpool. That was a breakthrough. That's when everything changed.
Right, Mark, true or not, did this happen or have I just made it up? One of Rennie's friends from where he lived in Gorton in 1983 joined AC/DC.
Ooh, could this be a yes? I'm going to say yes because I don't know.
It is true. Simon Wright, member of AC/DC, 1983 to 1989, also played in UFO and Dio and other bands of that era. Yeah. Right, John, I have one for you. True or not, I'm hoping you can clear this up. The Stone Roses nearly opened for or replaced Adam and the Ants on a bill.
They were going to... This is probably about the Patrol days, actually, I think.
Yes.
I think they'd gone into town to get one of the venues, and then the venue at Portland Bar, I think. They'd seen Adam Ant was coming in through touring, and they went to the venue to try and get the support for it, but I think they split up before the gig actually happened, so they didn't do the support in the end.
At the end of each episode, we each recommend something. This can be something you've liked for a long time or a recent discovery. I'll go to you first, Mark.
I'm really into a book at the moment by Richard Norris.
Yes.
It's called The Strange Things Are Happening. It's through White Rabbit. It's a fantastic book. If you'd have asked me 3 months ago, who's Richard Norris? I'd have said, oh, he's that bloke in The Grid with David Ball. But oh my word, this book, Richard, there's someone else described him as like Forrest Gump. He's a Z-League character. He's done amazing things. John will probably remember him because, like John, he's one of the few people who perhaps could lay claim to doing the very first British acid house record. This time with Genesis P. Orridge. Meet Every Situation Head On, that's the track.
I'm in the book.
Ah, you're in it.
When Richard was 13, yeah. He wrote me a letter because he was a Membranes fan.
Yes.
And he always mentions this. I was the only person he ever wrote to who wrote back.
Lovely.
It's in the book. It's actually in the book. It's quite sweet of him to actually remember to put it in the book, isn't it? Yeah.
And what would you like to recommend for us today, John?
Well, as you suggested, because I'm just fussy about my green tea, I should have mentioned that, but I can't remember the name of the tea bags. But the best green tea that I ever get is in Home, which is like the arty South Bank thing in Manchester. And they have this really amazing, really strong green
tea.
That
used to be the cinema.
It's still a cinema theatre kind of place. And they have this really strong green tea in there. It tastes that nice. But they're stopping, mate. They're going to stop it now because the teapot they sell it in, they chipped it in. They don't want to spend 30 quid on a new teapot. Which is my, so I'm going to have to bring my own tea in now because I'm fussy about my tea. I'm old. I'm allowed to be fussy about my tea.
Well, there we go. If you're ever in Manchester, you know where to get a good green tea. I'm going to recommend, if you've noticed, the England cricket team wear these bucket hats. Have you noticed this? So in between, when they're not batting, when they're on the sidelines and when they're doing interviews, they all wear these blue hats with the England cricket logo on that look exactly like what the Stone Roses used to wear.
And I remember in 1972, bucket hats were trendy.
Right.
In the north. So when the Roses got the bucket hat thing, it was like the second wave of bucket hats.
Yes. Because would the whole people wearing them at cricket and football, would that even exist without the Stone Roses wearing them?
It's really hard. It's quite interesting. This is the minutia of pop culture, which is always really interesting. You trace something that's really familiar back, and it actually ends up in a completely different place, doesn't it?
All that leaves us time for then is to say a massive thank you to the magnificent John Robb for sharing all his knowledge about the Stone Roses. Thank you, John.
Thank you. I really enjoyed that. I wish you could go on for about 5 hours.
Exactly. We could have kept going forever there. We only got up to 1989.
John will certainly come back, as we say, probably to talk about the Stone Roses, but God, he can talk about so much more. And let's give him a plug. His current book is The Art of Darkness, The History of Goth, 600 magnificent pages.
And we will, of course, have to put a pin in Blackpool, talk about the membranes.
Section 25.
We could do.
Section 25.
Jethro Tull.
We'll be back. We will be back. See you again next time.